Hey folks, Scott Weingar here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today we have a fun one. I got Dan and Howard from The Tox and the Hound. You know The Tox and the Hound, the amazing blog and Dantastic Tox podcast that's part of the MCrit Collective. If you're not reading their stuff, you're missing out. It's amazingly good toxicology information. But I got them to talk about something basic. And the reason why is I heard them on The Curbsiders talking about the toxidrome of anticholinergic toxicity. But they described it in a way you don't get from a textbook. They described it in a way that will burn into your brain, and you're never going to miss this again if you're at the beginning of your career or you're late, but no one taught this to you the right way. Before we start on the tox and houndadromes, the sepsis petition. Folks, there's probably no more important ask I've made of you than to go to mcrit.org/petition. Just pause the podcast and go right now to mcrit.org/petition and read what this new one-hour bundle is expecting from you. And then if you look at it and, like me, say, this is crazy, then please sign the petition. It's more important than listening to this podcast. Just go pause mcrit.org/petition and go look at it. And if you agree, please sign it. Do it now. This is really important. We're going to be hosed if we do not take care of this now, if we don't nip it in the bud before it becomes a core measure or becomes entrenched. So do that, please. Okay, enough preaching. Let's get to the podcast. Dan and Howard of Dantastic Tox talking about tox and houndadromes. And we'll start off the fun with anticholinergic toxicity.
You know, our discussion of this typically starts off, I'm a person that never likes mnemonics because I can never remember what the mnemonic stands for. And, you know, people remember a lot of the toxidromes. Certainly the anticholinergic one is blind as a bat, red as a hare. And it all runs together to me. It all winds up being hot as a bat, hot as a hare, hot as a beet, hot as a tick. So I never parse that out. And so, I typically tend to think of a couple of sort of overarching themes. Number one, anticholinergic, they're altered. There is a clear delirium with most of the agents. They have big, not reactive pupils, so midriatic and non-reactive. They're dry, and they're dry everywhere. So they're dry in their mouth, they're dry in their axilla, in their groin, they're holding in their urine, and they have, you know, the opposite of diarrhea, so they have constipation. So, and then they have some characteristic findings. So they have a characteristic voice, and their voice is kind of the ultimate in cotton mouth. So since they're unable to produce saliva, they're unable to phonate. And so their vocalization is, combined with the delirium, makes it very, very difficult to understand. And then the picking behaviors that are very characteristic of it, where they're just, you know, it's a combination of like the delirium and possibly some visualizations. And they're just sort of, they're grabbing at little bugs. Which is sort of one of the things that you from the doorway can take a look and point at.
They keep something. Taking off their pulse ox. They keep ripping off every single
everything.
Thing. What is?
Yep. You know, maybe it has to do with the temperature because they also tend to take off the gown and the monitor leads and pull and pick at everything. So I'm not entirely certain I could describe what they're experiencing having, you know, not been anticholinergic in quite some time.
So. Since yesterday.
Since yesterday, right.
Yeah, the only things I would add to that, because that's perfect description, is they often have stimulus evoked tachycardia. And mm-hmm. So they're usually going to be tachycardic anyways, just the same reason we give atropine. And I think that you kind of assume tachycardia is 140, but for a lot of these folks, you know, they're overdosed on an anticholinergic. That's also an antihistamine. And depending on where they are, they can be actually sleepy and somewhat anticholinergic. And what you'll notice is their heart rate while they're resting is 100, which first of all is abnormal. Like yep. Most people who are at rest don't have a heart rate of 100. We don't think of it as abnormal, but most, you know, 30-year-olds have a heart rate in the 70s or 80s when they're at rest. And as soon as you touch them or talk to them or get their attention, you look at the monitor and their heart rate jumps up to 120. And that's because in many ways, the blockade of all these cardiac muscarinic receptors means that the sympathetic system is left unopposed. So anything that, you know, activates arousal in these people is going to cause an exaggerated amount of tachycardia and even dilated pupils. So you can see, and I'll take a little difference with Howard there, you can see mixed pupils in some of these patients depending on which drug they took. A pure anticholinergic, and they're going to have great, you know, eight ball pupils. But a lot of times there's some mixed component in the drug, and you'll see pupils that are on the bigger side, but not like these ginormous, like, you know, 8 millimeter pupils. But the moment you get them alert or stimulated and you look at their eyes, they get wildly dilated. So, and certainly you're right, they don't constrict the way they should. They don't constrict down to a small, you know, size that you might expect when you put a pen light in somebody's eyes. But they're not always like enormously dilated. And the other things that I think is useless, but it's true, is I never listen to bowel sounds. I mean, it's the most, I mean, it's an okay thing, you know, to have a medical student do. but it's just, it's not helpful. First of all, I don't have the patience to stay there long enough to say, fair like, enough. did I hear a tinkle? Is that normal? Is it not? I don't care. There's nothing going on inside there in an overdose that I really care about. I don't want it to talk to me. And plus, I'm always a little afraid. You know, these can look, you know, a little exorcistist. I do not. I don't want to know if I'm going to hear something if I really listen closely.
I still haven't progressed to the stage where I don't touch patients like Dan. Yeah. So I still do things like put a gloved hand in the axilla or the groin and try and assess for dryness or moisture. There are a couple of restraining orders, but it's not really. I still think it's a useful adjunct, and the pupillary response I do think is helpful because, you know, in the contrast with a sympathomimetic pupil, those will be briskly reactive because you're stimulating the dilator, but the constricting mechanism is completely normal, as opposed to the anticholinergic pupil where you're modifying the ability to constrict. And so, you know, while it may not be as, you know, and nothing in medicine is as, you know, clear as that, they're definitely, you take a bright light and you really would expect the pupil to get much smaller than it does. So,
Yeah, the other thing I would mention is that when you talk to these folks, you know, and you approach them, what's your name? They have this ability to pay attention for about 3 seconds.
Yeah.
But that's different sometimes than some of the other truly delirious patients. So you can never get them to focus and to pay attention. They will usually start off by saying, like, you know, Mr. Johnson, why are you here? And they'll be like, I'm here because, you know, and then they just kind of mumble off. But you can get them for a very short period of time and then they're gone. I don't see that with a lot of the other overdoses. That seems to be fairly anticholinergic as well, that you can focus them, but you can't keep them focused.
So they have ADHD, but they're not floridly out to lunch.
Chemically acquired ADHD.
Yeah.
All right. This is fantastic. And this is getting into the stuff I love because, and you guys said it outright on the other show, which is you're making most of your diagnoses from the door. You know, if you just stand there and casually observe for a little while, you start seeing some of this stuff, like the picking behaviors, the taking off the gown, how they're talking to the nurses. And then you could go in and actually confirm by looking for the signs that you'd expect to be there if your initial suspicions, right? You can check the pupils. You could check the armpits with gloves because, you know, we're not there yet. But
you can do a rectal if you want to see if there's any, you know, moisture there too.
All right, that's perfect.
We froze.
Some stones left unturned, Dan.
How about the contrast? Cholinergic. How do they look?
So cholinergic, my visual mnemonic for that is basically SpongeBob and you squeeze him. And basically water comes out of everything. and so that's that cholinergic excess, you're right, you're crying, you're pooping, you're vomiting, you're sweating. Those are the outward manifestations. And then you have the things that hurt you, which are the killer bees. And that's the bradycardia, bronchorrhea, and the bronchospasm. So you drown, basically, along with, depending on the agent, you can also have some of the CNS effects, and particularly the ones that we worry about are the organophosphate nerve agents where you can have seizures. And so you have seizures and drowning. So the only, I guess, the only kind of time that you can say dry drowning and truly mean it. So
yeah, and I think the thing that's hard with the cholinergics, the anticholinergics can be hard in this respect too, is that unless you think about it, you're not going to make it right away. And even when you look at a lot of the outbreaks, it's often an astute clinician who's seen multiple patients come in who finally kind of picks up on this. It's not the kind of thing you're looking for in a busy emergency department, unless somebody says, I just drank this bottle of pesticide, which we really don't, we don't see that much in the U.S. Now, if you, if
not
you're
in
working
US.
In,
right.
That's right. If you work in Sri Lanka and in Nepal and in Africa and places that are much larger agricultural communities, this is a really common thing. And those emergency physicians are probably really good. And they can just from the doorway, they're going to say that's an cholinergic crisis, that's secondary to, you know, chlorpyrifos or one of the other organophosphorus compounds. So in the U.S., because it's pretty regulated, you're going to really have to think about it. And depending on the person's age, if you throw somebody who's short of breath, sweaty, diaphoretic, in front of anyone in the emergency department, you know, they're looking to activate a cath lab, you know.
Sure.
And I, that's the one, I mean, I missed, the one I missed was an older guy, 60s, who had all of the signs and symptoms of pulmonary edema. And it was really later into his ED course that I clued in the fact that he had really small pupils. And that is the one thing in, I think, the cholinergic crisis that if you look at least at the organophosphorus history and both agricultural as well as when it's been used as a weapon, that's pretty reliable. In fact, that seems to be the thing that ED clinicians eventually go, hey, wait a second. This person should have, you know, not have pinpoint pupils. I didn't give them an opoid. What's going on? Oh, wait, they're sweaty. Oh, wait, this is... That was one of the physicians. There was a big outbreak of a carbamate poisoning in the West Coast with watermelons, and it was an astute ED physician. And it almost always comes down to somebody eventually recognizing that the pupils are small.
Right, sweaty and pupils.
That's right.
All right, this is brilliant. So what I'm hearing is they look like a cardiogenic shock patient, sweaty, acute pulmonary edema, but then you think and look at the pupils and they're pinpoint. Is there anything else that would make those two patient presentations look different that'll keep us from intubating this patient and sending them to the cath lab?
They may be bradycardic, but bradycardia, you can, obviously, MI-wise, they could be bradycardic.
Right.
They can also be, they could be tachycardic. Heart rate's not as quite reliable in this as it is with an anticholinergic. You're probably going to be bradycardic in most of these, but, you know, you also have cholinergic receptors on your ganglia, including your sympathetic autonomic ganglia. So you could get, and you've got autonomic receptors on your adrenal gland. So, you know, you can see some tachycardia potentially in these patients. So even though bradycardia, we think about it, it may not be the, you know, the most reliable thing.
And then early on, they can also be tachycardic as they start to become hypoxic. And so as sort of a compensatory response. The other thing is that most patients that are having an MI are probably not pooping on themselves or crying. Well, maybe
Elvis did.
Yeah, that's true. That's, you know, they have these other things that don't typically go along with it. So that, you know, the lacrimation and the diarrhea, and so, you know, again, you have to be really tuned in to see what's going on.
Next up, we'll go into sympathomimetics.
Mm. This is Dan's favorite.
Oh, I do like a good sympathomimetic. I'll talk about it this way because this is how I like to talk about it. You know, again, I think clinically everyone recognizes this. And the thing that I always find fascinating about sympathomimetics is it's just an exaggerated normal physiologic response. And so when I'm usually trying to teach this, I'll tell people, just think about the last time you walked to your car at 3 a.m. and you heard footsteps. Like all of those physiologic, you know, changes in the fight or flight response that are activated are the same thing that you're seeing in a much exaggerated amount. And so, you know, first of all, your heart rate's going to increase. Why is your heart rate going to increase? Well, because you want to increase blood delivery to your skeletal muscle. And normally in a fight or flight response, that blood delivery is going to be differential, which means that it's going to shunt blood away from organs that don't need it at the time, like your kidneys and your gut, and it's going to shunt it to your heart and to your skeletal muscle. The problem with sympathomimetics and cocaine is it's going to vasoconstrict everywhere. And so you don't get that nice differential flow, but your heart rate's going to go up to deliver oxygen to your muscles. Your blood pressure can go up, more so with some of the sympathomimetics, depending on which neurotransmitter, you know, whether, you know, they're more norepi or epi or serotonin, but most of them are going to increase your blood pressure to some extent. In part, normally you do that because you're constricting blood away from your skin, shunting it to your skeletal muscle. And that's a good thing from a fight standpoint, because you might bleed less if your skin gets less blood. It's a bad thing if it goes on for a long period of time, because blood going to your skin is a really good way to release heat, and it's an effective way to dissipate heat. So your blood pressure is going to go up a little bit. Your pupils are going to dilate, and this is a fairly reliable finding with most sympathomimetics. They're going to have dilated pupils. As Howard mentioned earlier, they're going to constrict when you put light in them, but they're going to be pretty dilated. They are going to, and that's important. Most threats occur at night. You want a wide field of vision. You're going to sweat. You're often going to sweat even early on. You know, one of the things that limits people's ability to fight or to run is their body temperature. And so activating the sympathetic system results in this compensatory, you know, sweating, which is a good thing to lower your body temperature and to give you a better chance. And so these people are going to come in all over the place, agitated, and they're going to be sweaty, versus the anticholinergics, who might be all moving all over the place and should be sweating, but are not. And that's often one of the big differentiators. In addition, you're going to see these folks get what I term, as and others will, a psychomotor agitation. Like, if you've ever been like a little bit afraid walking your car, you're a little bit psychotic. If you walked around your workplace in that same condition, people would think you're nuts. You'd have, you know, your keys in your fist. You know, you turn around, you know, clenched, your jaws clenched. You often don't recognize it. You're biting and clenching down. Yeah. And you're paranoid. That is a normal physiologic response to prepare you for a threat. And all of these systems are activated by meth and by basalts and by cocaine. The difference is that, you know, normal fight or flight response is something that occurs in minutes. You know, MMA fights, there's a reason that they have 5-minute rounds. The human being was not meant to be that amped up for, yeah, if it's cocaine for an hour, or if it's meth for 6, if it's some basalts for 14. And that chronic activation of those systems is really where you see the big problems. And that's where you see the people come in with either myocardial injury. And you think about the rhabdo they get, right? They're doing all this motor agitation. They're moving all of their muscles. They're all over the place. And at the same time, they're not increasing blood flow to those organs. They're often decreasing it. So you get, you know, skeletal muscle injury. You get rhabdo. You get psychotic, both acutely and as well as if you use these, you develop some chronic psychosis. These are the folks that you can understand what they're saying. You just wish they would stop saying it. Because it's again and again and again. And they're paranoid, right? They're either somebody is out to get them, or is somebody is trying to kill them, or they have to get out of there. Right? They have to leave. Like, the anticholinergics sometimes want to leave, but they're usually content to playing with their bioxx. The sympathomimetics have to get out of there. They have a perceived threat. So, you know, you take all of that and you put it into the big clinical picture. You got somebody who's agitated, moving all over the place, tachycardic, sweaty, and hypertensive. And the vital sign that's critical that you really need to pay attention to in these folks is all of those and body temperature. Mm-hmm. This is the one that tends to get ignored, and it's because it's difficult to put a thermometer in somebody's mouth who's biting and spitting, and they're not usually as receptive to a rectal thermometer, but that's really what they need. You can do axillary, but it's not as good. Really, these folks need a good temperature, and you need it early. And if you don't get them under control, then you need to monitor it very closely, because you can develop fairly significant hyperthermia. Because one of the things that's unique about the sympathomimetic syndrome is not only does it increase all of these things that generate heat, like motor activity, and it decreases your ability to dissipate heat by causing vasoconstriction, it also blunts fatigue and exhaustion. And fatigue and exhaustion are normal regulatory systems that tell you when it's 90 degrees outside and you're going for a run that you should stop because your body temperature is about 104. And if you give somebody a stimulant, and that's why these drugs are blocked in competition, is it will blunt that normal feeling of exhaustion and fatigue. And this is why people get these stories of superhero strength and people, you know, tearing, you know, their restraints off and carrying six people out. They don't have greater strength than they did before they used the amphetamine. They just don't feel pain and exhaustion, and they're willing to continue to do things beyond the normal, you know, pain and the normal temperatures that would limit them. That was a long ramble. Sorry.
No, all good. Yeah.
Should we, I just think we should have a moment of silence for all the rats that contributed to Dan's knowledge of the subject.
I'm definitely going to rat hell.
So, you know, it's pretty easy when they're, you know, even talking to you, even in their psychotic way. I think where it becomes tougher is when they're using something like bath salts and they're just encephalopathic. And then, you know, they're profoundly hypertensive, tachycardic, and you start worrying, is this delirium tremens? Am I missing something else? Do I have to tap them? Is it an infection? Is there any way when they can't even talk to you at all, they're just floridly agitated and encephalopathic, that we could say, huh, this probably is a sympathomimetic as opposed to something else?
Yeah, I mean, short answer also is no.
Yeah.
Because we see a lot of them as clinical toxicologists and ER physicians, most of the time I'm comfortable saying I think this is, you know, cocaine, meth, whatever, some stimulant. I sometimes can't differentiate between them, and it doesn't matter. And I don't think it's meningitis, and let's just give them benzos. But it's really difficult. It's going to be really difficult to tell others that this one finding is going to differentiate it. Because you could say, well, what about white count? Well, stimulants increase your white count. You know, stimulants can certainly drive down your potassium, but people who are septic sometimes are going to have low potassiums, and it's hard to tell whether that's, you know, related or not. Your glucose is going to go up a little bit with a stimulant overdose because it decreases insulin release. But you can get that with sepsis too. I mean, so no, the short answer is no. And there is, if you don't have a story, if you don't have a history and you don't have the suspicion, they need a tap. I mean, that's truly it. And we all have an example. I think every toxicologist who does this has an example where they got consulted for it's usually for serotonin syndrome, are the ones that I've seen. And you come in and you're, something doesn't seem right. You know, maybe it's one-sided, their symptoms more than the other. You tap them and they got pus, and oh no, this is, you know, bacterial meningitis. So no, I don't have any.
No, there's no magic.
Fair enough. All right. I think we could do the next one pretty easily. And we're going to do opioids, but I don't even think we need to talk about the classic toxidrome.
What are
those?
I think
if you're not familiar with that, you deserve to be immediately fired from any job dealing with emergency patients.
Either that or you're practicing in a place that the rest of us need to find out what you're doing.
But then the addicts will follow rapidly. So,
I mean, the pupils are helpful. I think the most pathognomonic thing in an opioid is the respiratory rate. And that's the thing where pre-hospital, and I'm not blaming pre-hospital, but that's where they get every patient who's found down doesn't need naloxone. Look, right now, everyone probably does, so it's fine. Keep giving it, EMS people. I get it. Because, you know, if I'm in Vegas, I'm betting an opioid. But it's really the bradypnea, at least from my perspective, that makes the diagnosis. And this is another one from the doorway. This is the one I like to watch a patient from the doorway, and this is the only time I typically count respirations. Otherwise, you know, they're all 20 or 16 or whatever, whatever number we have.
One in your multiplier.
That's right.
Right.
But if you look at a patient, and I love to see them, you know, not on oxygen, if they've got a SAT of 80% and a respiratory rate of 6, right, that is a total mismatch. Like, they're like, normal human physiology would not allow you to live with a SAT of 60% and a respiratory rate of 6. That's an opioid. I mean, there are some other drugs, obviously, that can do that. But in the current setting, that's it. The pupils are often the thing I look at later on. But for me, it's the respiratory rate. And even the CNS, you got to be careful with a little bit, because you've probably seen this, Howard, and you probably have too, Scott, where you'll have a patient where you can talk to them and they're still hypoxic. You know, their SAT's still 80. And you'll have to wake them up and you'll have a conversation. They'll tell you they used heroin, and you're talking to them and you think they're pretty awake. And then you look at the monitor and the respiratory rate's still 8 and their SAT's, you know, 80%. And the thing I worry about in that is you really have to pay attention to the respiratory rate, because that's the what's going to kill them if you send them home.
Absolutely.
And sometimes I see people who are like, I think this person can go, they're awake, and they're, you know, they're rousing them up and they're opening their eyes and they're talking to them. They're like, oh, I think we can let them go. And I'm like, you need to leave them alone. Let's see what's going to happen to them when they go out
when
to their
stop
car.
Stop bothering them. Absolutely.
That's right. That's right. And so that to me is the big issue with these.
Sedative hypnotics. What do we need to know about how these folks look from the doorway?
These you have seen and created many of these. So most sedative hypnotics are fine in and of themselves. They're sleepy. And they have relatively preserved ventilatory drive and ventilatory status, unless they've combined it with something else. And in the current state that we're in, a lot of times the cause of mortality in opioids is combination with a benzodiazepine or a combination with ethanol. So mixed picture is different, but a pure set of hypnotic, a pure, let's say, oral benzodiazepine overdose is sleepy, and with relatively intact vital signs, across the board.
Yep. Anything to add,
Dan?
That's right. Nope. No, that's it. I think one of the things to highlight on that is that I'm not going to say it never happens, but it's pretty rare to need to intubate a pure benzo overdose.
Right.
I mean, even, and you'll see this all the time, and we see lots of these both at the Poison Center and in our four hospitals, is somebody who says, I took, they took 60 Xanax. And you're like, oh, they're going to need to be intubated. And they're not. They're fine.
No.
They tend to do fine. And benzos are more of that. You know, barbiturates and some of the other ones will eventually shut it off.
Oh, man, I can't thank you two enough. This has been incredible. On the next iteration of this, we will discuss the difference between serotonin syndrome's presentation and NMS. That's already in the bag, folks, but it was too long to put here. That will be out soon, so look forward to that. There you go. Remember to go sign the petition. If you go to mcrit.org, you will find show notes that list all of the factors and things that Dan and Howard discussed. This has been Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.